Thank you very much, Elizabeth, and it's for me a great pleasure to be here. I have been instructed to give you a capsule summary of the Greek and European crises in 25 minutes, so I shall try to proceed with as few wasted words as possible. My direct involvement with Greece began in 2010 at the start of the government of my friend George Papandreou, but evolved quite quickly into a very close association with Yanis Varoufakis on the grounds of his extraordinarily energetic commentary on Europe in general and Greece in particular. And I arranged for him to come to the University of Texas in 2013 for a two-year appointment from which he went directly to the elections of January 2015 and the finance ministry. And my engagement in that five-month period of the Varoufakis ministry was quite direct and practically around the clock, whether in Athens or in Brussels, or often just at home in Texas, but participating by electronic communications. What I want to do tonight is to just run through, I think, a skeleton of the outlines of this matter, and to begin by emphasizing that there are important aspects of this crisis which do indeed have to do with the historical characteristics and economic structure of Greece as a country, but I will argue that they are not really the heart of the matter so far as Europe as a whole is concerned. It is certainly true, to go back in history, that Greece has always been a relatively underdeveloped European country, with a relatively recent history of conflict and of fascism in the form of the military government that came to an end in 1974, followed by a predominance of oligarchs in important sectors who wrested unconscionable concessions from the Greek state, and a period of the development of a welfare state which was always, let's say, somewhat laggard, at least by European standards. Greece's admission to the European Union had consequences for its then existing industry. Trade barriers came down, and industries which were not fully competitive faded away, including important manufacturing sectors, which gave the country additional difficulties in terms of its balance of trade. The admission to the euro, as to the EU, was substantially political rather than economic decision, and it complicated the conditions of the country by removing the capacity to adjust the exchange rate, and therefore made its adjustment to unfavorable conditions even more difficult. It was followed, of course, by a period of economic expansion fueled by the inflow of funds, investment funds, credits of various kinds, covering deficits in the current account, deficits in the budget, deficits in social service budgets, as well as investment projects. The crisis, this, however, was not entirely unique to Greece. Similar, although not precisely identical, phenomena happened in other European countries, from Ireland through Portugal, Spain, and Italy. But the Greek situation was particular only in being perhaps the weakest of these countries from an economic standpoint. The crisis, on the other hand, was not a Greek event. It was a global event, and it was a global event whose origins were in the United States and stemmed from the gross mismanagement of the United States financial sector, which led to banking meltdown, as you might expect when banks are deregulated, they misbehave, that had severe consequences for the world investment community, including Europeans who had bought the worthless securities being peddled by the U.S. investment and commercial banks. This then created what was essentially a banking crisis at the European scale. And the banking crisis particularly affected banks in France and Germany, and was dealt with in 2010 in part by a pass-through loan to Greece. A pass-through loan which took the Greek debts which were no longer serviceable, essentially, off of the backs of the banks and passed them on to the backs of the European taxpayers all throughout the European Union, including countries in many cases that had lower per capita income than Greece itself. This package, which was a manifestly dishonest package, advertised as a bailout for Greece, was in fact was assistance to the banking sector, was covered by the participation of the International Monetary Fund, which was itself procured by highly irregular procedures, bypassing the internal review and over the objections of executive directors and staff of the IMF, in part because the IMF had no other business at that point, practically speaking, very little other business, in part because the managing director had political ambitions, which caused him to want to cooperate with the efforts to help the French banking sector. It was also a move on the part of the IMF that was supported by the United States because in 2010, the United States had just gone through a major bailout of its banking sector and did not want to have added complications, new complications coming from Europe that it might find difficult to handle. The IMF and the other major creditor institutions therefore imposed terms on the Greek state which were intended in effect to justify create a policy environment in which Greece could be judged as being compliant with the will of its creditors' institutions. These included a highly artificial and draconian target for a primary surplus in Greece's budget, a target which was extremely unlikely to be achieved on a sustained basis based on the historical record in Europe. It included what I would describe as an unethical experiment in the abolition of labor rights, the effect of total deregulation of an already weakly structured labor market. The mass privatization of public assets in Greece done in such a way that, or mandated to be done in such a way that the prices would be very low because assets sold all at once are unlikely to be sold in a way that will command a great return to the state. And of course, large cuts in the budget, including in the civil service, public service, and in pensions, reducing pensions of elderly and frail Greek citizens from, in some cases, as low as 330 euros a month to even lower values. The consequences of this program were, not surprisingly, not a return to competitiveness of the Greek economy, nor a recovery of growth and employment, but instead a general deflation, a ongoing decline in the quality of already weak public services in Greece, emigration of those who had the capacity to find work in other countries, and a massive rise in social stress, including homelessness, and hunger, suicide, and other signs of social disintegration, which were very visible to anybody who visited in this period from 2010 to 2015. In 2012, Greek debts were haircut in a way which did not affect the European official creditors, but did affect the Greek banks and the pension funds, and therefore further reduced the purchasing power internally in Greece. Governments came and went. Papandreou fell. He was replaced by a technocratic government, which was then replaced by a conservative government under Antonios Samaras that provided, in effect, a patina of compliance with extremely difficult and, I would say, impossible conditions, a policy which came to be known as extend and pretend. Extend the debts and pretend to comply with the terms. There was, of course, growing political dissatisfaction, the collapse of PASOK as a political force, and the rise of the coalition of the parties of the radical left, Syriza under the leadership of Alexis Tsipras, who became the largest party in Greece with the vote for the European Parliament in May of 2014, forced an election at the end of that year, and won it in end of January 2015, at which point Yanis Varoufakis became finance minister, and I got an email in Austin that said, get here as soon as you can. And I turned up in Yanis's offices on the 8th of February, 2015, and the first thing he said to me was, welcome to the poison chalice. So that was the title. That's how the title of my book came into being. The Greek government of 2015 proceeded on grounds to negotiate the terms of the program with the European partners in ways which I would now describe as fairly minimalist. That is to say, it approached the question from the standpoint of what can we ask for that we can defend in the most rigorous rational fashion, and it's the hardest to make a plausible case against. And that included asking for labor standards that would be compliant with the standards of the International Labor Organization, a very minimalist demand, a program for the privatization of state assets that would be conditioned on certain terms and conditions, such as labor conditions such as retention of an equity share for the government, and a pacing that would not cause assets to be sold at ridiculously low fire sale prices, a stop to pension cuts for the most frail and lowest income pensioners, that is to say the reduction of elderly and fragile people to complete destitution, and a above all a fiscal target which was still austere, but not irresponsibly so, a 1% target for a primary surplus rather than 3.5. As those terms were being formulated, president of the Eurogroup, Gero and Dijsselbloem, showed up in Athens and said bluntly to the finance minister that if they did not comply in full with the creditors' conditions as they stood, the European Commission would crash the Greek banking system, basically destroy the economy. Those were the terms from the beginning. Negotiations proceeded essentially on three levels. And it was a very interesting process, which I could go on about at some length, but I'll just say very briefly, the level of the institutions, the creditor, the technocrats, if you like, the IMF, the European Commission, the European Central Bank, who had no mandate to negotiate. It was very clear. Their mandate was to supervise the implementation of the previously existing program. And when they would extract a concession from the Greeks, they'd pocket it and say, that's good, let's go on to the next one. They had no capacity or authority to interact in any constructive way with the teams that Athens sent to Brussels. At the Eurogroup, the finance ministers, you might think a negotiation would take place. In fact, none happened. The Eurogroup was a forum dominated by people whose motivations were political in the sense of their internal national interest. The East Europeans were austerian by conviction, the Iberians by political convenience, because they didn't want to give Podemos or the Bloc Izquierda in Portugal something to talk about. The French and the Italians were unwilling to expend political capital on the Greeks, even though they professed sympathy in private. And the Greeks were essentially left friendless and subject to an aggressive media campaign that deprecated Yanis Varoufakis personally and in ways which were highly misleading as to the description of the facts. So the Eurogroup was not a useful forum. It was, of course, controlled by the very formidable German finance minister, Wolfgang Schäuble, who actually was an honest interlocutor and one that those on the Greek side, particularly Varoufakis, came to appreciate personally because he was at least direct about what he was doing. Ultimately, the question for Greece was whether a change could be effected by appealing to what was called the political level, that is, say, directly to Chancellor Merkel. And her position on Europe, whether directly or indirectly through, for example, the United States. which I played some role. It turned out to be futile, both because Chancellor Merkel, ultimately playing her cards very close to the chest until the end, was not willing to make concessions, and because the United States was not willing to pressure her because they had other priorities, specifically with respect to Ukraine. So the Greeks were basically on their own, and there was a squeeze over the entire five-month period. I haven't mentioned the debt because the early priority of the Greek government was to get relief on economic policy matters. The debts themselves, after a period of difficulty in making payments through the summer 2015, had been extended until 2022. And therefore, you could imagine if you could get through that summer that there would be time to discuss the debt question later. But in any event, never got that far. Through this period, the European creditors exercised maximal pressure on the Greek government, especially through the mechanism of emergency liquidity assistance to the Greek banks, which could at any time be revoked. Up until, I go into details, but up until the 4th of February, Greek banks could finance themselves directly. After that, they had to go through this ELA, political decision, and they, as that number grew up to, I don't know, 90 billion or so, it became an imminent threat that if it were revoked, the Greek banking system would simply collapse. Meanwhile, the business of making payments on debts exhausted the Greek reserves, every central government, but also provincial and health service and so forth, reserve was drained as you moved on toward the deadline of the 30th of June. Capital controls were imposed in late May. And to our surprise, the Greek public accepted them without complaint, and in fact, by intensifying their solidarity in support of the government. And what was impressive through this period, actually, was the way, the bravery with which ordinary Greek citizens faced these difficulties. It was something that was intensely moving to me as I observed it. Serious, solid people who recognized that they were supporting a government that was running risks on their behalf and who were prepared to do so. The difficulty was that the government itself was not as firm in its view of things as the Greek public behind it, and had made a decision relatively early, March or April, maybe as early as March, that they would have to eventually capitulate. And parts, elements inside the Greek government associated with the prime minister and the negotiating team in Brussels communicated that to the European authorities. So the finance ministry, while negotiating as effectively as it could, was undercut from within by its colleagues. The referendum was called for, was the 5th of July, and was viewed widely as an act of defiance. But I think it's fair to say, more accurate to say, that from the standpoint of the prime minister, it was viewed as a way of effecting a graceful surrender. That the idea was that a massive media campaign would terrorize the Greek public into voting yes to accept the terms of the creditors, and the prime minister could say, well, I gave it my best effort, but the public has made a different decision and capitulate on that grounds. The Greek public didn't cooperate with that scenario. And they voted 61% to refuse the terms and to back up what they thought was the government position that was indeed the position of the finance ministry. That night, and I was in Athens, Yiannis went from the finance ministry, having issued a rather defiant statement, to the prime minister's office at Maximos and made a decision that his position was untenable, and he resigned the next morning. What followed after a brief few days was a capitulation in toto, and what has followed since then has been the faithful, largely the faithful application of what were, in any event, draconian and have since become actually punitive terms imposed on the Greek people, including the dispossession of Greeks of every form of ownership to which they had previously been entitled as a sovereign nation, that is to say the ownership of public assets, those that make profits, not those that make losses, those were left with the Greek state. The ownership of private businesses, which has been squeezed between very high value-added taxes and deep cuts in the incomes of the potential clientele, and the ownership of private assets, including homes, which have moved into foreclosure at a rate that has engendered a certain amount of public and political protest, but which is taking one of the countries of Europe with the highest home ownership rates and turning householders into dispossessed homeowners and eventually renters if they can afford it. This is a very discouraging situation, and it shows in the people, it shows in the spirit of the country, and it shows in the prospects of the country, of which remain exceedingly grim from, and I think, any objective point of view. But it was never the purpose of the European creditors to foster a recovery of Greece. I'm sure they did not believe, and I know that Wolfgang Schäuble did not believe, that a recovery would follow. It was their purpose to set an example to discourage anybody else from defying the creditors and to impose similar policies on Paris and on Rome. And it has had some implications. I will not say that the Brexit vote was caused by a British perception of what was being done by Europe to Greece, but I won't argue, I don't think you can argue that the British public was entirely unaware of what was happening, or that the Greek crisis didn't condition, to some degree, British attitudes toward the European Union and the outcome of that vote, which was very narrowly decided in any event. And so far as Italy is concerned, I think the case is clear. A neighboring country in a parallel situation, which, however, took a different political route toward arriving at a defiance of the fiscal rules imposed on it by Brussels, and which is now quite forthrightly stating its intention to defy those rules. And this is a country which is, of course, 10 times larger than Greece, and a central founding member of the common market, the Treaty of Rome in 1960, and a country which the European Union cannot afford to lose. So I think we're seeing the implications of what happened in Greece in 2015 unfold before us now. This is a question now of the way forward, and I know that it's an open question in many minds, and there are many who have taken the view that the European mechanism as the European Union is unreformable, and that the Greek drama basically points the way toward the necessity to dissolve the ties that have been built up over this period. I would be skeptical of that approach because it seems to me, for what it's worth as an outsider, that the breakup of an existing union is a vector for the rise of the far right, national fascism, neo-fascism, as a consequence in part of the rapid decline of living standards that occurs in the adjustment period. And you see that in Yugoslavia, and you see that in parts of the former Soviet Union. Now, I don't think that the situation for Europe politically would be entirely separable from those, and you know as well as I do what the tendencies are as they stand. And that, for that reason, I'm, again, as an outsider, still associated with Yanis Varoufakis and the Movement for Democracy in Europe, which is a nascent movement, but one which holds to the idea that you have to continue to work toward a progressive reform of the continent as a whole that can make the institutions work in a humane way to stabilize and support their most vulnerable members, and not simply to operate as a debt collection agency under the ideologies that were promulgated in the 1970s and 1980s by far-right economists and whose failure has been manifest to us all for decades. For that reason, the Democracy in Europe movement is advancing the notion of a green, of a European New Deal, which does have some resonance with the North American and the U.S. experience of the 1930s, which was a continental, progressive continental construction of a unified economy. And that would include, among other things, a Green New Deal, that is to say, a major transformation of the energy basis of the European economy, a job guarantee program tailored to the needs of individual countries so that it would both reduce unemployment and the pressure for involuntary economic migration, a set of humanitarian social programs which would help create a better sense of solidarity amongst the peoples of Europe, and possibly, but not immediately, possibly a monetary reform, recognizing that a monetary system is not an ideological or spiritual absolute. It is not primarily a political symbol. It is rather a tool which needs to be made to function in a practical way. And if it can't be made to function as a single unit, it may be better to be made to function as two or several units, but that this should be approached in a sober and pragmatic fashion in order to find a way to take to make the particular circumstances of Europe, which involve, of course, supporting a lot of different, 28 or so different national units in very different economic circumstances, in a way that each and every one of them can survive and be sustained. So that's the task, and I think I've exhausted my 25 minutes, so I yield back the balance of my time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.